The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Putting an embassy exclusively in Erbil is likely to even further push American strategic interests in Iraq, as defined since 2003, into the background and make our ability to help Iraqis create a more sovereign, independent, democratic, and prosperous country. That's why we went into Iraq in the first place in 2003. It may be now, because of domestic politics, that those goals are no longer important to the American people. And if that's the case, that might be the logical extension of withdrawing an embassy to Erbil and simply putting relations with Iraq on the same level as relations with other difficult but not enemy countries in other places in the world.
I'm Scott R. Anderson, and this is the Lawfare Podcast for October 16th, 2020. The past year has been a difficult one for the U.S. relationship with Iraq, a country that has increasingly found itself caught in the middle of the Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign against Iran and Iran's own efforts to strike back at the United States. Now the relationship between the United States and Iraq appears to be reaching a new low, as Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has reportedly threatened to close the U.S. embassy in Baghdad unless the Iraqi government does more to thwart attacks against U.S. personnel stationed there by militias associated with Iran. But is the Trump administration really willing to take such a dramatic and seemingly self-defeating step? Or are there other factors at play? To find out, I sat down with someone who knows the situation in Baghdad like few others. My old boss from my own days at Embassy Baghdad, former Ambassador Doug Silliman. We discussed the threat to close the embassy, the legacy of the Soleimani strike for the bilateral U.S.-Iraq relationship, and what the future of that relationship might look like if Secretary Pompeo makes good on his threat. It's the Lawfare Podcast for October 16th. Ambassador Doug Silliman on the fate of Embassy Baghdad.
So, Ambassador, you left Baghdad in January 2019. And you were kind enough to join us here on the podcast a few months after that, I think in June of 2019, to talk about the state of the U.S.-Iraq relationship at that point. Needless to say, a whole lot has happened in that relationship and in the country of Iraq in the intervening 15 months or so. And that's really culminated in a pretty remarkable assertion or threat that's been leveled by the Secretary of State, according to media reports, as to the possibility of actually closing the embassy that you oversaw in Baghdad, where I was lucky enough to work under your supervision. Can you give us a little background? What, in your view, has really led us to this crisis point, I think is a fair way to describe it, in the bilateral relationship that might lead to such a dramatic outcome as closing what was for many years, I think may still be, America's biggest embassy overseas?
Well, Scott, thanks for having me back. And thank you for still valuing my opinion on this and presumably some other topics as well. I mean, the antecedents to what has been going on with the discussion of the U.S. embassy are numerous. I would say, in general, it is sort of a byproduct of the past 2 years U.S. and Iranian policy that began when the U.S. pulled out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action and imposed the maximum pressure campaign. The Iranians then put what they called the maximum resistance campaign against U.S. pressure. And the Iranians, for about a year, tried to find some way to convince Europe or China or Russia to push back and evade U.S. sanctions imposed in the Maximum Pressure campaign. But that just wasn't working. So in the summer of 2019, Iran directly and through its proxies in a couple of cases began to ramp up the pressure on the United States through our friends in the region. So you saw attacks on shipping, Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy planting limpet mines on oil tankers in the port of Fujairah. You saw the shooting down of a U.S. drone. You saw the seizing of a British tanker, all designed really to get the friends and allies of the United States in the region to consider walking back on the maximum pressure sanctions on Iran. When this didn't work, the Iranians last year in September of 2019 went a much bigger step, tried to bring the oil markets really in to put pressure on the U.S., and launched attacks on Abqaiq and Khurais in Saudi Arabia, the world's largest oil processing facility and a big oil field not too far from Riyadh. And the reaction from the U.S. administration to that, the reaction from the oil markets, was silence and boredom. And the Iranians really expected to have a more robust response, potentially that would cause the United States to relax sanctions or do something more extreme that could warrant a more extreme Iranian reaction. When nothing happened, the Iranians started taking at their word what the U.S. administration had been saying to them both publicly and privately, that the real American red line in the Gulf and in Iraq was a casualty to an American citizen. So then about a month after the attacks on Khurais and Abqaiq, when nothing really happened in reaction, you saw an uptick in violence from Iranian-sponsored militias, some part of the official popular mobilization forces in Iraq, some not, on coalition forces. And those escalated over the better part of 3 months until December. They actually succeeded in killing an American contractor on an Iraqi military base, which then set in motion what you will remember is a very quick chain of events of American airstrikes on Qataib Hezbollah bases in Syria and Iraq, an assault on the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, the killing of Quds Force leader Qasem Soleimani and PMF deputy Abu Mehdi al-Mohandas, and the response, Iranian use of ballistic missiles against a base that held U.S. forces. What happened at that point was that both Washington and Tehran were walking up to the edge of the cliff of full-on shooting war, but neither one really wanted that. So you saw fairly quickly in January of this year, both sides returning to their preferred method of operation. For the United States, it was imposing additional sanctions on Iranian entities. For the Iranians, it was to ramp up the pressure on the United States through the use of proxies. So I mean, the antecedents, the stuff leading up to this, was really the increasing focus of the United States on Iran, the pressure on Iran, and Iran's attempts to relieve that pressure in some way. What a number of Iranian officials have said very clearly since the killing of Qasem Soleimani is that the United States must be forced from the region in retribution for the killing of Soleimani. So forcing American withdrawal from the entire Middle East, all the areas around Iran, has become fairly quickly stated Iranian policy. They find Iraq the place where that is most likely to be accomplished. And you have now seen a significant uptick in attacks against coalition forces in Iraq, against the American embassy. And just like he did in 2018, when there were threats against the U.S. consulate in Basra, Secretary of State Pompeo very quickly escalated threats in hopes of getting the Iraqi government to take greater steps to protect U.S. forces in the field, U.S. forces on Iraqi bases, and the U.S. embassy and its consulate and associated compounds. So, again, a very long explanation or antecedents for a very simple question. The real question that I have in my mind is this threat from Pompeo really a threat to close the embassy? Because as I look at the size of the embassy, the interests that the United States have at stake in Iraq and in the region, it's pretty obvious to say that if the United States were to close its embassy in Baghdad, Iran and the supporters of Iran inside Iraq would see that as a great strategic victory over the United States. And I assume that, especially because the current prime minister of Iraq, Mustafa al-Kadhimi, has worked closely with the United States and understands our point of view on these issues probably better than any previous Iraqi prime minister, I suspect they don't want to do anything to undercut his authority and his ability to govern or to take steps to lessen the impact of the militias or Iranian influence in Iraq. So I'll stop there. Otherwise, my filibuster could go on for the rest of the podcast.
So, Ambassador, that's an incredibly useful synopsis of the rapid series of events that has led us up to the current moment, this crisis that we're in the U.S.-Iraq relationship. But before we go on to that next point about this question of strategy and what the motivation is behind the U.S. actions to threaten to close the embassy, I want to bring in the third actor in this that often gets overlooked in some of these discussions, these affairs, which focus on, understandably, the United States and Iran and their struggle. That third actor is, of course, Iraq, a country that is, as it has for many years, found itself between the United States and Iran. Famously, a number of Iraqi officials after the Soleimani strike raised concerns and objected, begged American officials, essentially, don't make us your battlefield between your struggle with Iran that has their own interests, and frankly, has been undergoing their own political struggle. We saw a number of governments collapse as part of a failed government formation effort. And then, I believe in May of this past year, we finally saw Prime Minister Kadhimi come up, a kind of unlikely candidate, someone who is seen by some circles, at least, as somewhat more pro-American or pro-Western than some of the other candidates that had attempted and failed to form a government. Tell us a little bit about Prime Minister Kadhimi, his administration, how they've managed this tightrope relationship between Iran and the United States, and how that's fed into the current state of affairs.
Well, Scott, that's a really good observation that Iraq has not really played a big role in determining these policies. And frankly, that is the problem that Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi has had to deal with. He does not want his tenure as prime minister to be about solving disputes between the United States and Iran. He is a, if you will, new type of prime minister. He does not have real political backing from any of the political blocs. He does not have a strong bank of support inside the parliament. He has derived his political strength largely from the protests that have been taking place in Baghdad and through the southern part of Iraq over the course of the past 2 years. The people who have been asking for reforms so that the government will be able to provide effective services, reforms that will reduce and eliminate corruption in the government, reforms that will give young Iraqis an opportunity for jobs, and maybe most importantly and most emotionally, some idea of what Iraq stands for. One of the most popular slogans during this period of protest has been Nuridu Watan, which means roughly in English, we want a nation, we want a country. But in many ways, it's an emotional statement that means we want an identity. We want something that we can call Iraq, on which we can hang our hat, in which we can place our future hopes. And Prime Minister Kadhimi is really the embodiment of this idea. Can he reform the vision of the future of Iraq? Can he reform the government to provide electricity and water and education? Can he reduce or end corruption, which is rampant in the Iraqi government? Can he make changes to the economy, both for foreign and domestic investment, that will create the jobs that young Iraqis need? So the last thing that Mustafa al-Kadhimi needs right now is a struggle between two countries which are really crucial to Iraq, Iran and the United States. And I think that this is one of the big problems that he has to deal with. And he has been trying, through the appointment of some very good economic ministers in his cabinet, to work on provision of services, restructuring the economy to promote entrepreneurship and investment. And they have made a number of legal cases against relatively senior people who have been accused of serious corruption. So this is his main objective, in addition to simply arranging for the next elections to take place, since he is technically a transitional government. The reality is, however, the political battle is going on over the presence of U.S. forces, the presence of the American embassy, and the more radical Shia militias and political parties and Iran are trying to define this issue as the most important. For most Iraqis, it's not the most important. A majority of Iraqis would like to see a continued U.S. diplomatic and military presence in the country, both to continue the fight against ISIS, but also to show that America continues to want to push back against complete domination of Iraq by Iran. So there are many different sides to this, but politics in the parliament really are polarized now. And Khatami has got to succeed on these bread and butter issues and manage the very difficult struggle between Washington and Tehran if he's going to succeed.
Well, and that pulls in, I think, another camp that it's worth dissecting here a little bit, and that are these militia movements. Because, of course, some of the logic by which the Iranians, for the reason why the Iranians tend to work with or through militia groups and proxies, not just in Iraq, in other parts of the region, is a plausible deniability. Is this question always of, are these groups acting independently, or are they at the direction of Iranian officials, implements of Iranian policy? And my sense is that answer may vary sometimes across time, across circumstances, and across individual groups. And of course, the militia problem that we think of today with Qatib Hezbollah and a bunch of other groups that do have clear ties to Iran and Iranian officials historically, pretty much openly acknowledged, they are part of a broader popular mobilization unit community of these PMUs, many of which were formed or at least kind of formalized as part of the counter-ISIS effort, then were brought into the government and still exist as a part of the formal national security apparatus of the Iraqi government, but often acting very independently, often in ways contrary to the directions of Iraqi officials and in pursuit of their own interests, verging on the criminal in many cases, or full-heartedly embracing the criminal in many cases. Tell us a little bit more about these militia groups, their relationship to the Iranians, and the role they've come to play in this kind of post-counter-ISIS campaign Iraqi polity.
Scott, that's a really important question that you raised, and unfortunately, there's no real easy answer. All I can say is that the popular mobilization forces or the militias or the Shia militias, however people want to talk about them, are not a monolithic group. They are a number of separately constituted groups, most of which have a Shia identity, not all of which listen to Tehran. And I break them into roughly sort of three categories. A group of irregular forces that were formed in 2014 to press the fight against ISIS as they came across the border from Syria. A second group is a group of pre-existing militias, such as the Badr Corps, who are very much Shia and sectarian in their identity, but in many ways are more Iraqi Shia nationalists and want to make sure that Iraq remains a Shia country as opposed to an Arab country or a democratic republic, or whatever you might call it. There's also a third set of these militias that are very much willing to take orders from Tehran and have from time to time been more or less vocal in their support for Iran's vision of politics in Iraq. So these are three broad categories. The problem is within these groups, there is jealousy, there is competition, and the killing of who was arguably really the head of the popular mobilization forces, Abu Mehdi al-Mohandas, along with Qasem Soleimani in January of this year, removed the key leadership element that was able to mostly unify command and control of the Shia militias and the pro-Iran militias. Now there is a lot of competition among the leaders of these groups for the mantle of Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis. Who is going to emerge as the preeminent commander in the popular mobilization forces in the Shia militia orbit? Another thing that is difficult to explain clearly is that most of these militias have numerous simultaneous identities. They are Shia militia groups that operate outside the control of the government. They have part who are inside the popular mobilization forces and therefore formally the government structure. They have associated political parties, most of which have representation in parliament, and they have associated economic arms that they are trying to expand upon so that they can increase their economic base through economic activity, such as buying up companies that are being, government companies that are being privatized. So you can't say that any of these groups are strictly a militia, but they, since they have different identities, they try to conveniently shift back and forth among these identities to fit what is most convenient and expedient at the time. So I really see a lot of these militias as, you know, part government security force, part militia, and part mafia. And it's going to be very difficult to characterize these, any of these groups in any one of these categories, and therefore even more difficult for Prime Minister Khadami to regularize and regulate them, train them, and get control of them, because they will shift and form and change their identity to make that more difficult for him.
That really leads me into, I think, another factor that is worth thinking about, looking a little bit in hindsight at the trajectory that we've seen the U.S.-Iraq relationship take over the last year, year and a half or so. And that is, there does seem to be a pretty distinct inflection point, at least to me, although I'd welcome your views if they're to the contrary, around the Soleimani strike. The Soleimani strike has really been discussed in various circles with people strongly defending it, strongly opposed to it. But a lot of times the defenders' arguments are that it was a necessary effort to reestablish deterrence, I think is the phrase that former General Petraeus used in saying that it might have been a good idea to essentially try and make clear the consequences of threatening U.S. troops and personnel in Iraq. But then as you noted, it also has these negative consequences, both at least, if nothing else, in removing some senior leadership. Certainly, those are people who may have threatened the United States, been involved in violent attacks against the United States by many people's views, may have deserved some sort of justice. But you also are creating a degree of unpredictability, opening up leadership structures. You know, you're trading the devil you know for the devil you don't in a lot of these circumstances that can lead to unpredictable outcomes. As I guess the question I want to pose to you is, looking back at these last 6 or 9 months that have passed, 10 months that have passed now since the Soleimani strike, do we see it as having effectively accomplished its purported mission of reducing the threat to American personnel in Iraq? Or does it appear to have been perhaps a step in the wrong direction?
Well, I think I'd answer the question completely differently and say, first of all, I don't think that Washington sees the decision to kill Soleimani as an inflection point. I think they saw it as a pressure point, again, based on information that I had seen over the decade previous to this. It's very unlikely that Soleimani was going to come to Iraq to direct attacks against the United States. I find the proximate cause that was laid out by Secretary of State Pompeo, that he was coming to plan attacks on the U.S. Embassy and U.S. personnel, implausible based on what I know. But it is clear that orders from Tehran given by Soleimani would have been crucial and were crucial in what was going on in, as I said, this tit-for-tat battle that you saw over the previous 2 years between Washington and Tehran. I frankly am still conflicted myself about whether it was a good decision or a bad decision. As someone who knows the pain and suffering and death that Iraqi militias with Iranian support and Iranian-provided weapons inflicted upon American and coalition forces over the course of the time, especially from 2003 to 2011, it's hard to not say good riddance. On a larger global scale, I was disturbed, however, by the direct assassination by the U.S. government of a senior official of another government, which I thought left a lot of American and other allied officials of, you know, of the United States at much greater danger should this particular behavior be normalized by other states. But maybe more to your point, what the killing of Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mehdi al-Mohandas has done is both upset the leadership, command and control structure for the Quds force and the especially the Iraqi Shia militias, but it has also given Iran and the pro-Iran militias a martyr to celebrate. And if you go to Baghdad, you will see huge billboards all over town, especially at the airport, of Soleimani and Mohandas. They are, I presume, around the country as well. And given those militias in Iran a reason to press harder and justify violent action against the United States, whether it is coalition forces on Iraqi bases or the U.S. embassy, in the name of and because of the killing of Soleimani. So on balance, operationally, I think it has made it more difficult for the U.S. to keep its people safe on the ground in Iraq. It has also had some unintended, I guess, positive impact in making it more difficult for Tehran to issue specific orders and have them carried out inside Iraq. But it's had the negative impact of starting a minor power struggle among the remaining militia leaders as they try to expand the number of people who are associated with them, increase their income, and gain more control over key transportation nodes and economic institutions. So I think a lot of the rationality that was in the militia activities and the activities of the PMF before the killing are made more difficult to control by the loss of the command and control structure.
Let's go back to from the last major, well, at least one of the last major strategic decisions the Trump administration has made, right, in relation to the present one, this question of closing the U.S. embassy. You noted earlier this has some doubt about whether this was a serious threat, or maybe perhaps I'm misinterpreting your statement, whether the real motivation was about closing the embassy as opposed to some other sort of objective that might serve. What is the strategic calculus that is going into Secretary Pompeo's leveling of this threat, which in many ways, as you've noted, would be fulfilling a long-term objective of Iran and several of these militia groups of driving down or severely reducing at least the U.S. presence, the United States diplomatic presence in this case in Iraq. Is this really something that is there another line of logic? Is there some implicit threat behind the threat to close the embassy? Or is it much more about a risk mitigation and reduction as is kind of the public narrative that's been put forward?
And Scott, I must say, I honestly don't know the answer to that question. And I sort of all the time in my head posit potential strategic objectives for this action. And I mean, I come up with some different options. First of which, if the goal of the United States in Iraq is really to prevent Iran from taking over, to strengthen the Iraqi government, to help it stand on its own feet, to resist Iranian pressure, removing the American embassy would very much go against that strategic objective. So the larger strategic objective of pushing back on Iranian adventurism and excesses in the region, in my mind, would not be served by fully closing the embassy. If the goal is to support Prime Minister Khatami or to pressure Prime Minister Khatami to do more as a government to ensure the safety of American forces on Iraqi bases or the U.S. and other foreign embassies, there are at least 100 steps that I can think of that the United States could take to show the seriousness of its concern and use that as leverage on the Iraqi government to get the Iraqi government to take specific steps that would help protect our people in Iraq. Only if the pure calculation of Mike Pompeo is the prevention of any American casualties does this move actually make sense. If he is trying to avoid a Benghazi-like incident, especially after his role in the Congress and what he said about the role of Secretary Clinton and what he defined as her failings in the deaths in Benghazi. This is the only way, in my mind, that completely closing and shuttering the embassy would make sense to me. And again, what I don't understand is what political calculus the administration is using. If they're looking at America's interest in the region, the success of the Iraq project, attempting to link Iraq to other friendly Arab countries or friendly of the United States, Arab countries, keeping an embassy in Baghdad is pretty important. If they're trying not to prevent an Iranian victory, it's probably also important to keep an embassy there. But if the goal is really just to prevent American casualties and the focus is an American domestic political goal, not an international strategic goal, then completely closing the embassy makes sense. So again, I assume that the embassy closing would be a worst case scenario for everyone involved, but I have seen Washington take relatively few intermediate steps to put pressure on Khadami other than just talking to him. Now that they've invited him to Washington, done another round of the strategic dialogue, they may have a better sense of what he is willing to do to protect Americans there. And frankly, since the strategic dialogue last month, I have seen fewer threats from the administration to completely withdraw personnel from the embassy. But they've kind of left it out there as a point of pressure, I think. So again, I can't answer your question because I don't know the strategic goal that Secretary of State Pompeo or President Trump are really aiming toward, whether it's international strategic American interest or whether it is domestically focused, preventing American casualties and getting America out of the endless wars in the Middle East, as President Trump has pledged to do.
So we talked about the diplomatic presence in Iraq and the implication of potentially closing the embassy there. But of course, that's just part of the U.S. presence in Iraq. The United States also has a substantial troop presence engaged in some counter-ISIS operations, engaged in certainly training and equipping Iraqi forces, based primarily, by my understanding at this point, out of Iraqi military bases around the country, kind of within the security perimeter provided by the Iraqi military. And as far as I'm aware, the threat to withdraw the U.S. presence has been focused on the embassy and the diplomatic presence and not on these military forces, perhaps because they are seen as more secure, perhaps because we've already seen a restructuring of the U.S. troop presence over this past summer, where it seemed like there was a realignment and a kind of drawdown, at least of certain levels and types of personnel that in part followed from some calls that arose after the Soleimani strike among the Iraqi parliament and other quarters urging for at least steps towards a wind down of the American troop presence, although no serious steps were taken toward an immediate cessation of it. What would the withdrawal of the diplomatic presence mean for the military presence there? And perhaps more importantly, the actual mission it's pursuing, both in improving the effectiveness of the Iraqi military and in pursuing the continuing counter-ISIS operations that remain, at least on paper, a major strategic priority for the United States.
I will say, Scott, that's a really good question. And the answer, as always in Iraq, is very complicated. I'll note that between 2011 and 2014, all of the U.S. military training and mentoring and equipping of the Iraqi security forces, and this is particularly the counterterrorism service, was done out of the U.S. Embassy with people who had diplomatic status. It was not Title 10, combat U.S. military personnel on the ground. So it is possible to conduct a lot of the military policy that the United States would like to accomplish with the Iraqi armed forces and the counterterrorism service and parts of the police without combat troops on the ground. The second thing, a lot of the American intelligence and fire support for Iraqi forces in fighting against ISIS isn't actually launched from inside Iraq anymore. A lot of it is done from bases farther away in the region. I don't know how many drones are still based in Iraq, but most of the airstrikes have been done by planes who are no longer based in Iraq, and it's been that way for several years. What is important about the on-the-ground U.S. presence, and that's really the coalition presence. It's not just the U.S., but the other 16 countries that are part of that presence with us, is the day-to-day contacts, the mentoring, the mission planning that goes on. This could be done in other ways, but it's done much better when the coalition forces are co-located and able to have good access to the Iraqi military headquarters for this kind of planning and mentoring. So that's the one thing that the current forces are able to do that would suffer, and particularly the operations, continuing operations against ISIS would suffer. There has also been a significant role for the U.S. military in negotiating, brokering, mediating relations between the Iraqi security forces, the Iraqi police, and the Kurdish Peshmerga over the course of the years. And this is another role that might be weakened if those coalition forces were withdrawn. I would add that the resistance front, the pro-Iran Shia militias, have not given up on the idea that American forces must leave the country. They say all foreign forces must leave the country. And a week or so ago, when they declared a truce, a suspension of attacks on American targets, it was stated publicly that this truce is only in effect as long as they see progress in the full withdrawal of American forces and foreign forces from the country. So while there has been a tactical pause, I presume, if not dictated from Tehran, probably negotiated between Baghdad and Tehran, given the pressure that Prime Minister Khatami was under to do things to protect the American presence. This underlying idea that all of this is only suspended and the ultimate goal is to get American troops and the American diplomatic presence out of the country. And what has been interesting in the past month, and even since the truce was put in place, or this unilateral ceasefire was put in place, a number of leaders of the militias have really lit into the American embassy as being a den of spies, people who are trying to take over Iraq and prevent Iraqis from developing their own independent future. They're trying to use rhetoric to put pressure also on the embassy and seem very open about seeking the departure of the American diplomatic presence as well as the military presence. So not really an answer to your question, but spinning the various variables around it.
No, and in a way, I think that's really the only way you can approach a question with so many moving parts, as you noted. But I want to throw one more in your direction about a little bit of a hypothetical, which is that let's assume Secretary of State Pompeo makes good on this threat and decides to draw down the diplomatic presence in Baghdad. That leaves the United States with one diplomatic presence left in the country. There used to be a consulate in Basra in southern Iraq that was closed in 2018, if I recall. We still have a consulate in Erbil that I presume would remain open under this threat. It is not, to my knowledge, under the sort of regular threat or assault from militias, as is the embassy in Baghdad. In fact, it's in the independent Kurdistan region, which is substantially autonomous, has a separate political identity from the rest of the country in a lot of ways, sometimes at loggerheads with the central government of Iraq. What would it mean for the realignment of the U.S.-Iraqi relationship to have that sort of presence in the country? And what kind of consequences should we expect to flow from that in terms of the broader relationship?
Well, Scott, you've made a lot of assumptions there, and I kind of want to unpack the assumptions behind this question and start by saying I doubt that the United States will simply shutter the embassy in Baghdad. As I said before, there are at least 100 intermediate steps that the United States could take to show its displeasure with militia violence, with the inability or unwillingness of the Iraqi government to take the steps that are needed to protect American diplomatic personnel. At the end of the day, if I assume that we close our embassy in Baghdad, including all of the associated logistics operations, and essentially move the ambassador to Erbil, he would still be the ambassador to Iraq, not the ambassador to a semi-autonomous Kurdistan region of Iraq. So I think from a legal standpoint, he would still be the American ambassador and people would still be accredited to the Iraqi Foreign Ministry, not the Kurdistan Region Department of Foreign Affairs. What that means In practical terms, however, is much is just a lessening of our influence and our ability to interact both with friends in Baghdad, but also people who aren't quite sure where they stand, and absolutely with opponents in Baghdad. It would leave the United States really unable to deal with Prime Minister Khatami and the main government ministers as directly and as frequently as we do now. So I think it would undermine our ability to get the Iraqi government, to convince the Iraqi government to take the steps on security, on economic reform, on corruption, on foreign direct investment, on a whole host of questions that we would like them to. So it reduces the effectiveness. It would potentially embolden the Kurdistan region again to seek independence, perhaps. But I'm pretty sure that Washington would caution Erbil, as we did in 2017 with the referendum on Kurdish independence that was conducted unilaterally by the Kurdistan regional government, caution the Kurds to not go too far from its relationship with Baghdad and to continue to work in that relationship. So there are risks in getting too close to the Kurds. There are risks that many Kurds will see us as supporting Kurdistan over Iraq. And what it does is opens up a number of fundamental questions for the administration on what are the goals of our Iraq policy? Are we there solely to push back on Iran? Are we there to build a close ally in Iraq who would be a long-term partner in regional stability and regional prosperity? Are we there because we owe to Iraq our best efforts to make Iraq turn out well after we intervened in 2003? I think it will bring up the very fundamental questions of what is Iraq for the United States? What resources do we wish to pursue? And I'm afraid that putting an embassy, putting an ambassador exclusively in Erbil is likely to even further push American strategic interests in Iraq, as defined since 2003, into the background and make our ability to help Iraqis create a more, to use a very hackneyed phrase from policy, to sovereign, independent, democratic, and prosperous country. That's why we went into Iraq in the first place in 2003. It may be now, because of domestic politics, that those goals are no longer important to the American people. And if that's the case, that might be the logical extension of withdrawing an embassy to Erbil and simply putting relations with Iraq on the same level as relations with other difficult but not enemy countries in other places in the world.
Well, that is a great transition to what's going to be the final question I want to put to you in our conversation today. And that is, I want to turn those questions back on you as someone who's advised presidents on and other senior officials on the U.S. relationship with Iraq. What, in your view, are the interests that the United States has, whether strictly narrow and myopic and political, or perhaps, you know, moral and ethical as well? What interests should the United States have in Iraq and in the relationships there? And what should the Trump administration or a Biden administration, if that's the direction the election goes next month, what should the future of a presidential administration do in its engagement with Iraq and with other regional actors to best work towards those interests and preserve them and accomplish the objectives they're supposed to be working towards?
I think the United States has really never come to grips with why it went into Iraq in the first place. And therefore, it's been hard to define what we want to get out of Iraq in practical terms. I think that there was, in 2003, in the Bush administration, a desire to remake Iraq in a Western image and create a democracy where Iraqis would vote for governments that would implement the interest of Iraq, which the Bush administration, by and large, felt would be parallel to, if not always the same as, American interests. In other words, economic development, not wasted energy on a theoretical war with Israel, and building of alliances in the Middle East, particularly post-1979, of friendly Arab countries against what people saw as Iranian expansionism, and trying to find ways to prevent terrorism that produced terrorist attacks in the 90s and 9/11 could be reduced somewhat. For those of us who spent a lot of time in Iraq in the period between 2006 and 2014, the rise of ISIS, I think a lot of the desire was really to implement the slogan that I said earlier, an independent, sovereign, democratic, and prosperous Iraq, to help the Iraqis build a country that would actually work. And sort of like the bull in the china shop, since the United States went in 2003 and essentially broke Iraq, there were a lot of people in the bureaucracy, in the military, and in the Bush administration and the first part of the Obama administration who thought we had a responsibility to make it turn out as well as we possibly could. There was also, however, realism in the Obama administration about Iraq and Afghanistan, where the president essentially said, we have to come up with more realistic goals to end or walk back our engagement and the cost of our engagement to the United States. And I think that President Trump has simply, and particularly with regard to Afghanistan, has taken that even farther by saying, we want relationships and we want intervention overseas when it provides specific benefits for the American people and doesn't simply perpetuate this idea of American global leadership. So those are all the ideas that I think have been thrown out there over the course of the nearly 20 years that we have been engaged in Iraq. The reality is there are several things that could happen in Iraq that could hurt American interests. First of all, were Iran to essentially take over the Iraqi government and be able to project its power through Shia allies in Iraq, into Syria, into Lebanon, into the Gulf more readily, it would make it much harder and make our allies and friends in the region very nervous, certainly in Jordan, certainly in Saudi Arabia, and definitely in Kuwait. What I think, though, is probably the biggest issue for the future of Iraq is those hundreds of thousands of young Iraqis who have been protesting in the streets over the past couple of years as representative of the new generation of Iraqi youth. What is really interesting is that in Iraq, the median age, the age, if you meet an Iraqi on the street, that person is most likely to be 21 years old. The same for the United States is 38 years old. When you have a population that is that young, you have people who don't have jobs, who have an incomplete education, are unsure of their identity as a people and as a country, and they don't have the life experience to personally deal with not having those things. It is quite possible, if the Iraqi economy collapses, that there could be a wave of Iraqi refugees very similar to the wave of Syrian refugees we saw during the years of violence in Syria starting in 2011. And this is where the interests of the United States maybe are not as directly affected, but certainly the interests of the countries of the region, the interests of Iraq's near abroad, and particularly Europe, might be engaged. So as I look at the future of Iraq, one of the things that the next administration, whether it be the Trump administration or a Biden administration, probably needs to do is re-engage with our closest European and Asian allies on how we want to collectively deal with Iraq, because I think in the medium term, it is Europe and the countries surrounding Iraq that have a much greater risk of bad outcomes if Iraq itself has a bad outcome.
Well, we are out of time, so we'll have to leave the conversation there. But Ambassador Doug Silliman, thank you so much for joining us here today on the Lawfare Podcast.
Scott, thank you very much, and maybe we'll talk again next year.
In person.
Inshallah, as we say.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution.
Please take a moment to rate and review this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you might be listening. This podcast was engineered by Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo and edited by Jen Patcha Howell. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.